Hi, it's Allison, producer at On My Mind. Today's episode is an interview from Diane's archives with PBS's Judy Woodruff. She joined Diane on the podcast in May 2018, just after she was named the permanent solo anchor of the NewsHour. Prior to that, she'd co-anchored the show with Gwen Ifill until Ifill's death in 2016. Earlier this year, Woodruff announced that she'd be stepping down. Her last show is December 30th. Enjoy the conversation and Happy New Year.
Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On My Mind this week, PBS NewsHour anchor Judy Woodruff. She was named sole anchor this past March. We talked about covering Trump, the passing of Gwen Ifill, and breaking into the news as a woman.
I answered the phone, cleaned the film, wrote letters for the news director, and kept bugging him to let me go out and follow a crew. And his answer was, whenever I would bug him, would be, Judy, we already have a woman reporter.
Here's Judy Woodruff. Judy Woodruff, it's great to see you.
It is wonderful to be with you, Diane.
Will you tell me what that moment was like when you were finally named sole anchor of the PBS NewsHour?
The truth is, it was more than a moment. It was a period of time extending over many months that led to this. After my beloved partner and dear friend Gwen Ifill died unexpectedly in November of 2016, not even a week after the election, something we never expected to happen. She had had a cancer diagnosis. She had been fighting it. Everyone thought she was coming back. She told us she was coming back. I had seen her just a few days earlier. It was a huge blow, of course. It left an enormous hole in all of our hearts, as in the hearts of anyone who ever knew Gwen, watched Gwen,
absolutely,
heard Gwen. And we didn't have a succession plan. We expected Gwen was going to be there for a long time to come. I was going to be there, at least for the foreseeable future. We were co-anchors. But when that happened, I think we reflexively thought, okay, we'll find another anchor. You know, we've had two.
Did you?
We've had two anchors, and so we will find someone to take Gwen's place. Well, of course, that's not as easy as it sounds. Gwen is unique. Was unique in American journalism for so many reasons. And we, after months of thinking about it, there came a time when we started to think, well, maybe the better thing to do is to think about this as a sole anchor and building, again, a wonderful team of correspondents, occasional substitute anchors, people who are growing and coming along. And fortunately, Diane, we had and we continue to have this extraordinary team of journalists.
Absolutely. Did you at first really want a co-anchor?
I did. I thought that the Gwen and Judy partnership was working really well.
It was great.
It was working really well. She, you know, it goes without saying, she came with extraordinary journalistic credentials. She is a brilliant woman, was a great partner. I didn't even think about doing the show solo. Of course, Jim Lehrer had anchored the program solo ever since Robin McNeil retired. I think it was in 1995. So Jim had been the solo. But when Jim retired in 2011, we kind of naturally fell into a multi-anchor situation. And then the two of us, Gwen and me, and that was what we thought we would continue. But I think as we thought about it, as I say, it just became clear that maybe the better thing to do was stick with one. And I'm comfortable now.
Good.
I'm comfortable in this
role. You seem that way. Certainly you seem that way on the air.
I am. And it's I tell my team as often as I can, I'm here because of all of you. You come every day, you give it your all, and this show wouldn't be what it is without this extraordinary group of reporters and producers.
Your team is majority female.
I haven't done the exact count, but on the air, we certainly have strong women who work for us, from Lisa Desjardins to some people we've hired recently, Yamiche Alcindor, who's covering the White House for us. Lisa covers Capitol Hill. A new person we've hired, Amnon Nawaz, who came to us from ABC, is a correspondent. She had a long career at ABC and before that at NBC, had worked internationally. Of course, our executive producer is a woman, Diane. You know her, Sarah Just.
Of course.
So it's great. And we have some fabulous guys working for us. Our senior producers on the air, names everyone recognizes, from Jeffrey Brown to John Yang, William Brangham.
So wonderful, all of them. If I may be so bold, you are 71 years old.
Yes, I am.
Prior to Gwen's untimely death, would you have been thinking about retirement? And here's the reason I ask. We asked our own listeners to post questions they had for you. And the most frequent statement that mm-hmm. was made was, please, Judy, don't retire. So I found myself wondering whether you had plans to retire before Wednesday.
You know, it's a wonderful question. It's logical at this point in our lives. We think about it. You're raising your hand
absolutely.
As I'm saying this.
Absolutely.
But I had made no plan. Certainly, it was something I talked to my husband about every once in a while. But the naming of Gwen and me as co-anchors was so fresh. It happened in 2013. What is that now? It seems like it was only yesterday.
An
it was
age ago.
Not even 5 years ago. And so that was something that still had to bear fruit. I mean, we felt we had so much more to do together. There were not only elections to cover, there were new administrations, there were issues, there were changing stories. The world is changing, our country's changing, our culture is changing, women are changing.
Of course.
Journalism is changing. There's just so much going on. It's almost as if I feel I'm living in a new era. Of this country and of journalism.
Tell me about that, and especially what it's like for you covering this particular administration at this particular time.
It is like no other administration. He is like no other president. He brings a unique background, a unique approach. We report on it every day. We don't report on it wall to wall the way some news organizations do. Of course, it's important to follow the president and to follow what he's doing that's of consequence. But we do spend time thinking about what is of consequence. What is it that he is saying or doing that is enduring, that
matters.
But
these tweets come so quickly.
They do, and we weigh every one and decide, is this something we should report, or is this something we can let it pass? I know somebody out there is listening and saying, well, wait a minute, who are you to decide what matters, what's above the line and what's below the line? And my answer to that is, honestly, I think we are better equipped than a lot of folks to make that decision, because the collective wisdom of the journalist on our team is something like several hundred years, and that's covering Washington, it's covering this country, it's covering the world. You put all those heads together, and I like to think that we make more good calls than bad ones.
And in the face of the calls you make, you're up against a president, if I may put it that way, who thinks that everything out there except Fox News is fake news. How do you deal with that?
That is certainly what he says. I don't know if he believes it, but it is what he says, and it's what he says often. My strong view about that, Diane, is that our role is to report on it when it matters, but not to get into some kind of contest with the president, where we are on the defensive, trying to prove ourselves, trying to defend our role and our work day in and day out. My view is that what we have to do is get up every morning, put our shoes on, go to work, and frankly, that happens from the time we open our eyes, because the news is happening from the time we open our eyes, and put our shoes on and start working and figure out What are the important stories of the day? What are the American people? What does our audience need to know? How can we best give them that information and go from there?
What time?
And not worry about a contest with the president.
What time is that first call?
There are email exchanges that go
before.
On almost all night long, starting right. very early in the morning before 6 o'clock sometimes, but certainly by 6:30, 7 emails. We have our first meeting at 9:45, where we sit down in person together, and those who can't make it to the meeting are on the phone. And this is the larger group. There are probably 20 people in that meeting talking about, first of all, we look about, what did we do on the program last night? Did we do what we needed to do, what we wanted to do? And then we talk about what are the main stories of the day, how do we approach them, what guests can we get, is this story edited or not, do we have the technical capacity to be in those places we need to be. There are all kinds of decisions that have to be made.
And how many times during the day might that whole vision change?
5, 6, 7, 8 times. It used to be that you'd come up with a plan coming out of our 9:45 meeting, and you'd stick with that plan until 6 o'clock at night. Maybe you would change it once. On a rare day, you'd change it twice. Now it changes often. We are often confronted with it's not just the Trump presidency or the White House or breaking news about the Trump presidency. Sometimes it's something that happened overseas in reaction to the Trump presidency, just like the story this week from Israel about Iran. Those kinds of stories, you could say, are mirror reflections of what's going on in Washington. We cover them, and they've taken on a greater importance because Donald Trump has there are waves of effects of what he does here in Washington that touch every country around the world. You could argue that's the case with every president. I would say with this president, it's more immediate. You sense from leaders in Europe, in the Middle East, in Asia, that they are responding more quickly to what the president has said or tweeted.
Judy, you and I have been in this business for a long time. Talk about your beginnings.
Well, how far back do we want to go,
Diane? Early on, Judy.
Well, I will try to condense this long and circuitous story. I grew up as an Army brat, born in Tulsa, Oklahoma. My mother's family was from there. Father was born in a small town in North Carolina. At 5, we moved to Germany. My mother and I followed my father to Germany. My father was sent to Taiwan. My father was assigned to Fort Gordon, Georgia. I eventually joined them in Georgia, finished high school in Georgia, went to college in North Carolina, then came back to Atlanta for my first job. Along the way in college, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. My mother had never gone to college. She did not even finish 10th grade. Her father died when she was 14 years old. She stayed home to take care of siblings while her mother held down 3 jobs.
Wow.
And she told me throughout my growing up years, an education is what matters. You must get an education. You must be able, essentially, she would say in so many words, to support yourself. And then in terms of choice of a career, I started out in math because I happen to be good at math. I like numbers. I love science. But I couldn't figure out what to do with math, and my teachers who taught me physics and math, frankly, didn't think women should be taking calculus and so forth. So I found that I was really loving a course in political science. I changed my major in college from math to political science, worked in Washington for 2 summers for my congressman from Georgia. The second summer I worked on Capitol Hill, the women I worked with on the Hill said to me, don't come back to Washington after you graduate from college because women are not given a decent opportunity.
Oh my.
This was the late 60s.
Yes.
I was told, you're going to be a clerk. They said, you can even come here with a law degree. You're going to be a clerk. You're not going to get the job that you want. I told them what kind of work I want. I said, I don't know. I want to work in an agency. I want to work on the Hill. I went back to Duke my senior year. I was lamenting all this to a professor. He said to me, well, did you ever think about covering politics?
Huh?
And it was as if a light bulb went off in my head.
I know the feeling well.
I had never studied journalism, never written for the Duke newspaper, didn't know anything about it, but I thought, there's an idea. I thought maybe a woman can get a decent job in journalism. I applied for a job at all 3 TV stations in Atlanta. The only one that would hire me was the ABC affiliate, and I was the newsroom secretary.
I see.
I answered the phone, cleaned the film, wrote letters for the news director, and kept bugging him to let me go out and follow a crew. And his answer was, whenever I would bug him, would be, Judy, do you want to be a reporter? We already have a woman reporter. So, of course, what we found, what happened in math, what happened in Washington, and of course it was the case in journalism. But you know, Diane, this was a moment. It was the late 60s, early 70s. Women were coming into their own. And honestly, under the Richard Nixon administration, there was a push for the commercial networks to for stations, if they were going to get their license, they had to bring in more women. They were told, you have to have more gender diversity. This was the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And I know, I don't know directly, no one ever said this to me, but I know as I look back on that period, there was pressure on stations and on the networks to hire more women. And so I'm sure, in a broad sense, I benefited from that.
And what happened next?
I bugged this news director so much, he got sick of listening to me. And I also made myself known to the other news directors in Atlanta. They weren't giving me the time of day. I got a copy of Broadcasting Magazine, went through the index, found every radio station I could find in the country that was looking for a reporter, a beginner, anything in the news department. I wrote about 60 letters. I think 10 of them wrote me back. And to a person, they said, we don't need a woman. We don't think a woman's voice is credible in news on radio. So, Diane, you you know this story very well. I was incredibly discouraged, but then the phone rang one day, and it was the news director at the CBS station in Atlanta, and he said, come on over for another conversation. I've just lost two of my reporters, and I want to talk to you. And he called me, and he knew I wanted to cover the state legislature, and he sent me to cover the Georgia state legislature. First assignment. Can you imagine what an amazing baptism by fire
Amazing. That
was? And I got to walk the halls of the state capitol building. I got to meet legislators. There were 280 of them from all around the state in the House, another 60 in the Senate. And I got to know them one by one and loved it. I covered highway bills, tax arguments, politics. I learned I learned a lot. And guess who was running for governor of Georgia that year? It was 1970. He had run for governor 4 years earlier and failed. He was a state senator, peanut farmer from Plains.
His name was
Jimmy Carter. And so I covered his time as governor as I was covering the legislature, got to know all the people around him. And then at the end of that five-year period, when I was watching my colleagues at the CBS station go off to San Francisco and New York, I thought, my life is passing me by. So I went knocking on the doors of the networks in New York, had the temerity to literally cold call them. The only one who was even friendly was NBC. The vice president at least listened to me for half an hour. And then he said, you know, go back to Atlanta, take some voice lessons, call me in a year.
Wow.
So this was the end of 1974, and I went back to Atlanta. I got out the yellow pages, found voice coaches, made an appointment with someone, and then 4 days later, that NBC vice president called me and said, we just fired one of our correspondents in the Southeastern Bureau for NBC. Could you just quickly send us another tape? But it looks like the job is yours.
Wow.
I ended up taking one quick voice lesson after I went to work for NBC and was scheduled to take another one, but I was on the road so much. I was general assignment. I covered fire ant plagues in South Georgia. I covered blackbird kills in Kentucky, my first story for the network. I covered a hanging in the Bahamas. Meanwhile, I was saying to NBC bosses, hey, pay attention to Jimmy Carter. He's a serious candidate for president.
Absolutely.
They initially said, no, no way. Nobody takes him seriously. But he did, and then they let me cover him a little bit in the beginning. And then when he started winning, they pulled me off because there were so many correspondents who were ahead of me in line. And I could understand it now. Back then, I did not understand it. I said, I'm the one with the contacts.
Exactly.
I don't care who they are. So I was very discouraged. And I almost quit. I almost left NBC when they took me off the campaign. But I was talked out of it by a very good friend, a journalist then, who said, you'd be crazy to do this. Just take a breath.
Hang in there.
I did. They let me come back and cover Carter's campaign in 76 as the third man on the totem pole. I was the backup to the backup. But that allowed me to keep my, you know, my hand in there. I broke some stories during that year, especially during the transition. They eventually said, okay, you can go to Washington and cover the White House. And so I was number three at the White House. I covered weekends and Today Show stories, and I did that. I covered 4 years of Carter and two of Reagan.
You know, I wondered as you were speaking, of course, NPR was just getting off the ground, and I wondered whether you ever made any overtures to NPR.
You know, I didn't, and I think it's just because I was so focused on my immediate surroundings.
Yeah.
I came, initially it was Atlanta, and then it was Washington, and it was CBS. And when CBS didn't work out, I had only talked to the networks. And then, after 9 years at NBC, not even 9 years at NBC, my good friend Robin McNeil and Jim Lehrer were expanding their half-hour news program on PBS. And I was already, even in 1983, Diane, I was thinking, wait a minute, I'm not getting as much time for these interviews on the Today Show. I remember one day I was preparing for an interview with Secretary of State Shultz, and I had prepared, stayed up half the night.
Of course.
And some little news thing happened. Something happened in Hollywood. I don't remember which
celebrity.
Blew it up. Almost blew it out. I ended up with, I think, 3 minutes with him. And I came away that day and thought, is this really what I want to do?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in retrospect, you know, many people say, well, of course, you know, news is news. You're going to be crowded out no matter. But at the time, I was very focused on trying to find a place where I could do serious, meaty stories. And the NewsHour just seemed like this exciting place. They were the first national news program with the courage and the guts to push and persuade the stations around the country to give them a whole hour. That, you know, the commercial networks had all talked about, maybe we're going to give you, I mean, at NBC, the discussion had been, okay, the affiliates are maybe going to give you another half an hour. It never happened. And to this day, they do a half
exactly.
hour.
Exactly. You know, as you are talking, I'm remembering my own beginnings and wondering about all those young women and men now who are facing a pyramid as far as journalism is concerned. The difficulty to really break in to the larger picture. Obviously, there are lots of different outlets now. It's not easy.
It is not easy, but I tell every young person who asks me, who says, should I go into journalism or not, whether they're in high school or they started college, I say, look, if you are curious, if you have lots of questions about the world around you, whether it's about politics or the environment or international affairs or science or law or whatever it is, and you love the pursuit of answers, and you don't mind working in a crazy, unpredictable environment where deadlines are a factor, and frankly, nowadays, every second is a deadline. You know, there's no longer the 6 p.m. and the 7 a.m. It's every second is a deadline. If you don't mind living in that crazy, cockeyed environment and working in that environment, then jump in. We need smart young people. I tell them to jump in. I say, look, you don't know where you're going to end up. We don't know what, and we are in the middle of such a transition right now.
Absolutely.
We don't know whether news is going to be delivered, you know, how much longer. People say, well, TV may not be around. I think we're going to have some form of video for a long time.
I do, too.
People are going to want to look
at
pictures. They're going to want to listen. We're always going to need a form of radio, audio, whatever you call it. And the printed word is always going to be important.
And the other thing I like to say to young people is to get that broad degree first.
For sure. I tell if they haven't already committed to a major in journalism or in broadcasting or something, that I describe as craft-related. I encourage them to stick to the liberal arts.
Exactly.
You know, major in philosophy or English or history or economics, if you're interested in that. Whatever your broad interests are, get a broad liberal arts education. Then you can narrow it after you finish college. And by the way, you're going to be learning your whole life. Education is from the time you are born until the time you take your last breath. We all keep on learning.
Hi, it's Diane. Join me for my next book club event, a conversation with Sheila Johnson. She's co-founder of BET, all about her memoir, Walk Through Fire. That's coming up Wednesday, April 24th at 6 p.m. Eastern. Find out more. Register at dianeween.org/book club. Judy, I'm going to talk with you about the number of high-profile men who've been accused of sexual impropriety. We've seen people like Charlie Rose, Matt Lauer, and even more recently, Tom Brokaw. He and you worked together at NBC at one point. What's your reaction to the fact that Tom Brokaw has now been accused?
I was surprised. I had not heard this particular story when it came out. I worked with Tom Brokaw. We overlapped. We were never in the same city at the same time. He was in New York when I came to Washington, and before that I was in Atlanta. He was always very kind to me, very supportive. He was someone who, when I was in New York, he was one of the two, I would say, mentors of mine. John Chancellor was both a friend and a mentor, always made time whenever I'd go to his office to talk about a story or to ask his advice. And Tom was the same. They were both very busy people, but they were always very supportive. And I went to both of them as I was thinking about whether to take the NewsHour offer. And both of them took the time to talk to me about it. So I didn't have any awareness of that. And just to broaden it out, Diane, I've been stunned, shocked by the revelations. Some, I would say, more than others. I mean, there were rumors about some of these individuals who've now been named publicly.
Such as?
Well, I don't want to say. I mean, there were people I had heard stories about. But never anything that was concrete enough to say, well, wait a minute, somebody should be reporting on that. It was always, well, you hear this, and it was third or fourth or fifth hand. So I've been shaken by all this and sobered by it. And I take it all very seriously. I haven't dismissed any of these allegations that I've heard, because my response is, I wasn't there. I don't know what happened. And I think we have to respect what these women have said. We don't know what happened in any of these instances.
Do you think the incredibly large group that have been accused, are they and their example going to make a difference? Do you think that men will back off, and do you think that women will be more assertive in speaking out?
I believe so. And why? Because I think that there's enough of a national conversation about this right now. Everyone has been talking about it. There are now informal and formal groups of women that have been formed. I know there are in journalism, and there's a group in Hollywood that's come forward to represent and speak up for those many women in that world. There are certainly women being represented in among labor unions, just across the economic spectrum. What I hope, what I don't know is how long-lasting is that? I haven't seen any movement before like what we see today. So I believe that it has the legs, the energy, the determination to keep going. I certainly talked to my daughter about it. She's in her mid-20s. We've shared we've had a lot of conversations about it. I talked to the young women in my office at the NewsHour about it and women on the outside. It comes up frequently in conversations in ways I don't expect it. Men bring it up to me. So I do believe that this has staying power, but I will say this, Diane, it's going to take that concerted effort that's being made now has to continue.
To continue.
And continue and continue.
Absolutely.
Or else we will forget. So, and the same for men. Men have to keep talking about this among themselves. I'm hearing some of those conversations, but those have to continue.
Judy, you mentioned your daughter. Tell me how your son is. He was born with spina bifida.
That's right. His name is Jeffrey. He was born in 1981, so he's now 36 years old. He was born with a mild case. Spina bifida is when there's an opening, literally an opening in the back of the spinal cord to the outside. It has to be repaired very quickly after birth. When they didn't know how to do that, before, I guess, the 1960s, these babies did not survive. So Jeffrey, born in 1981, there was a procedure. It was becoming more and more common. In his case, it was lower in his back, so that means there was less neurological damage. The opening is the outer symbol, if you will, of neurological damage on the inside. So Jeffrey walked on time. He has skinny legs. His calf muscles haven't developed very much. He walked flat-footed. He had to wear orthotic supports, but he was able to walk. He was active in school. Was a great swimmer, skier. And dealing with other issues. He was bladder and bowel incontinent, another part of spina bifida that so many of these children have. When Jeffrey was a teenager, he had to have a procedure done that was normally considered pretty routine. Something went terribly wrong during that surgery. He came out of it in a coma. He remained in a coma for several months. And when he came out, he was very changed. He could no longer walk again. He had to relearn speaking. His vision was impaired. Speech was impaired. Didn't have the use for fine motor of his right arm. So he can only walk now with support, with a walker. But generally, he uses a wheelchair, and has a significant short-term memory deficits. So it was a devastating thing for our family. It changed us forever. I would wish it on no one. I've said, and I mean it, is the worst thing you can imagine, short of losing a child.
Yes.
But to see your own child's life change so drastically. Having said all that, Jeffrey is a young man still of great spirit. He came a long way. He had to learn how to read and do everything all over again. He ended up finishing high school. He was 16 when this happened. Missed a year of school, came back, finished high school, went on to finish college. It took him 8.5 years to finish college, but he did. He works today he has a part-time job working for a wonderful college in Westminster, Maryland. Lives in a group home there as part of a fabulous program that's run by McDaniel College. And we are
Which I sat on the board of directors
And
for
you
many
know
years.
What a wonderful school that
I
is.
I do indeed.
And you know what this program, which is called Target Educational and Community Services Incorporated, they do amazing work for individuals with both intellectual and physical disabilities.
Indeed.
Jeffrey is the great beneficiary of that. We see him a lot. He comes home to Washington a lot. He is as smart as a whip.
Can he drive?
He cannot. His vision's impaired, and his motor skills are impaired, and his memory is impaired. So there's a lot. There's a sort of a global picture of impairment that makes his life. He needs help essentially with all the activities of daily living, from transferring from bed to wheelchair to vehicle, with preparing meals and toileting and bathing.
So indeed, it did change your family's life.
Completely changed it, and in a way that makes us appreciate all the good things that we have. His younger brother and sister have been extraordinary. You know, we've all been affected by this because we love Jeffrey so much. But you know what? He's taught us that individuals with disabilities can have as full a life as everyone else. It may not appear that way on the outside. They may not be able to hold a job the same way everybody else. They may not be able to get around physically like everyone else. But in Jeffrey's case, he has a fully active mind. He's on the computer all the time. He reaches out. He has lots of friends he reaches out to.
I'm so glad.
And it's taught us that people with disabilities deserve every opportunity as everyone else.
Indeed. Let's talk about last weekend's White House Correspondents' Dinner. Were you there?
I was not. Al and I, my husband Al Hunt and I, were out of town.
Did Michelle Wolf, in your mind, cross the line, the comedian who entertained that group?
I have not heard her entire remarks. I've heard excerpts. The excerpts I've heard are pretty rough. I mean, her personal description of Sarah Huckabee Sanders was pretty rough. And it made me uncomfortable to listen to it and to watch the video reaction of Sarah while she was hearing it. I mean, how much do you want to physically run somebody down? I know that if you're, I'm a journalist. You're supposed to be fair game if you're in public office. It is said that you put yourself out there and you're it's open season. But we're all still
human beings.
We are human beings.
With feelings.
And we have feelings, and there's something about human decency. And so I think that part of what she said went over the line.
What about what she had to say about Kellyanne Conway?
I didn't hear that.
Pretty bad. Pretty bad. If a tree falls in the woods, how do we get Kellyanne under that tree?
It's mean-spirited, and I actually haven't been attending the White House Correspondents' Dinners for a number of years. I went
Why not? Every year for a long time.
Well, Al and I, my husband and I, both of whom, he's a journalist. He's with Bloomberg News.
This
is after a long career at the Wall Street Journal. We went to so many dinners. I think we felt that they began to change and just weren't as much fun anymore. We love seeing our friends, but the atmosphere at the dinners changed. And so we just, we haven't been in several
years.
Do
you think some change needs to take place in order to come back to the origins of what that dinner stood for?
Well, what I believe, Diane, is that we are now at a moment when journalists in this country need to be thinking very hard about what our role is and how we fit into the larger picture of our democracy. So not just doing our daily job, which we need to do, but we also need to spend a little bit of time thinking about how do we fit in to this moment in American history when we have a political leader who is saying that we are enemies of the American people, and as President Trump said in the last few days, that we hate the American people. I know that is not the case. Maybe among some individuals it may be, but I don't personally know anyone who feels that way. I know the president expresses himself very strongly in that regard, and I think what's happened is the American people are now a significant portion of the American people, as we see this in the polls, are starting to answer, well, yes, I agree. The press is not only irresponsible, they are fake. They don't love America. They don't seem to be patriotic. And I think because of that, we in the media have to be thinking about that in everything we do to make sure we are doing our jobs well, accurately, we're reporting the news accurately, that we're being fair. Not that we're being defensive about what we do, but that we represent ourselves in a way that speaks to the values that matter to us.
Do you think there has been something lost in journalism that needs to be recaptured?
I think something's been lost temporarily. I don't think it's gone forever, and I don't think it's been lost among all journalists. I think there's no question that in the election of 2016, too many journalists, I think, got caught up in the bigger picture and didn't spend enough time talking to individual voters, getting out in the country and talking to real Americans across the country, red states, blue states, hearing what the concerns of the American people were. I think many of us bought into a narrative. Maybe it was because we were talking to too many campaign managers or campaign strategists. And I think what we've got to do in the future, starting right this minute with these midterm elections, is make sure we are listening to the American people, that we don't think that we've got it all figured out, that we know better than they do. I think part of the problem in 2016 and today is that too many Americans think reporters and the press in general thinks we are smarter than they are, thinks that we know more than they do, and we look down on them. And that is just a bad place for us to be. I don't feel better than anybody out there. Yes, I've been in Washington for a long time. Yes, I've been a reporter for a long time. I think that has value. That adds up to something. But that doesn't make me better than somebody. And I think some of us gave the impression, you know, collectively, that we just kind of were kind of know-it-alls. And I don't think that's a good place for us to be. We shouldn't be pitted against the American people. We shouldn't be talking about flyover country. I mean, we should be out there talking to people. Too many of us, honestly, spend all of our time in Washington, New York to a lesser degree, maybe a little bit in Los Angeles, I don't know. But a lot of us, too much in Washington, and we need to get out.
Well, to end this wonderful conversation, let me just say or repeat what our listeners have said. I certainly hope that you, Judy Woodruff, are going to be in that anchor chair for a long time to come. Congratulations to you, and thank you so much for giving our listeners this time.
Thank you, Diane. It's such an honor to talk to you. You know I'm a huge Diane Rehm fan. This is an extraordinary treat for me to have this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music was composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Adrian Danhauser. Thanks for listening. I wish you and your loved ones a happy and healthy holiday. We'll see you in the new year. I'm Diane Rehm.